Thanks, Tabby. So the thing they never... I'm Nathan. I'm with my wife, Lucy. We come to this church. You always feel like when we do the 4 o'clock, you have to say that because we normally come to the 6:30 because we feel much more like student-y. And definitely the 4 o'clock is a warm-up. This feels a lot better already so far. It's a much better service, so thanks for coming to this one. The thing they never warn you about when you preach is that there isn't quite enough room on here. And so I sort of shuffle through, and then some PowerPoints will appear behind, and I can't see them. And there's all that sort of, no, they don't appear up there. These sort of general level of stress. But what I did get, I got some great feedback and advice from Bob, who told me it's really good to listen to your own sermons. So as a busy father, I thought what I'll do is I'll listen to it while I go to the gym. So I like to go to the gym with our 16-year-old. It's my kind of daily humbling, as he's far fitter than me. And I'm in the gym, and he comes over and he says, what are you listening to, Dad? So I said, oh, a bit awkward. I'm actually listening to back-to-back sermons. And he said, oh, right, who by? Yes, actually by me. Now, I can say that I did agree with all my points, but what I did worry about was I told the same story twice in two different sermons, and I realised it was exactly the same structure. But tonight is going to be different. We've got a whole chapter of Samuel. So the way I'll do it is we'll split it into five parts. It's like a dip in as we go across. So I'll read a bit on the screen, and then I've highlighted some in yellow, the bits that kind of stand out. And I'll give you a bit of, just like a bit of fabric to kind of, so it's got a bit more oomph, so you understand the background. And then I will, I'll pull out a bit of context, and then we'll move on to the next one. Five of them, 20 minutes, 3 minutes each-ish, and we'll see how we go. But you'll notice I've called this the counter-currency of Christ. If you're an English teacher, you'll be very pleased, because I think that's got a word, isn't it? If you, it all starts with the same letter. Ah, thank you very much, an iteration. But if you're a theology student, you'll be thinking, David lived 1,000 years before Christ. But of course, the countercurrency of God doesn't quite work as well. So I called it the countercurrency of Christ. But also, actually, David pre-lives out what God's doing. And then we see when God comes to earth as Jesus, so God in human form, he lives out this countercurrency. So what is currency? We talk a lot about it in our family. So this £5 note, when you are 6 years old and this arrives in a birthday card from your aunt, you are a millionaire. This is the greatest thing you'll ever receive. When you then get a bit older and you go and buy a drink in a nightclub, I'm led to believe, I'm too old, but I'm led to believe you wouldn't get change from that. Or if you go for two coffees, you won't get change from a fiver. So I want to redefine what currency is. It's value, it's what we trade in. And the world will give you a currency. There will be things that you think are very important, that are very valuable. Maybe academic ability, maybe that's really important. Or maybe your status, or the way you look, or the way you appear to others. It's what you think about. It's what you makes you think valuable and make other people valuable in your view. It's that idea of forsaking something in pursuit. So if it was status, you'd forsake all others in your pursuit of status. So far in the story, we've met David, and he's waiting to become king. This happened 1,000 years before Jesus was born, and it's in kind of where is modern-day Israel now. And in tonight's story, what's going to happen is David's away fighting. His enemy do a raid on his village, and they take hostages. He goes on a rescue mission with 600, but 200 are exhausted, so they wait. And then he collects, clearly he's going to win, bit of a spoiler, but he then has the spoils to share, and who will he share it with? So I'll read the first part, and just a little note on reading this. Basically, the pronunciation of various old words in the Old Testament, I'll just say them with a confidence, but don't reuse that pronunciation like you think it's right, okay? So I'll just do it because it helps us read it, but you may want to find out how to say it yourself at some point. So 3 days later, when David and his men arrived home in their hometown of Ziklag, they found that the Amalekites had made a raid into the Negev and Ziklag. They had crushed Ziklag and burnt it to the ground. They had carried off the women and children and everyone else, but without killing anyone. When David and his men saw the ruins, they realized what had happened to their families. They wept until they could weep no more. David's two wives, Ahinoam from Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal from Carmel, were among those captured. David was now in great danger because his men were very bitter about losing their sons and daughters, and they began to talk of stoning him. But David found strength in the Lord his God. So who are they? So the Amalekites are descendants of Esau. So 800 years before this, so we're now like going really back in history. So this happened 1,000 years before Jesus, 800 years before that. In Genesis 27, it was really important when you gave someone your blessing. So if I've got two children, if I blessed, the elder one will always have a greater status. Unfortunately, they're a female, so that wouldn't have happened back then. But the elder one had greater status. And what happened is the younger one tricked the father who was blind out of that status, out of that blessing. It was quite easy to do because the older one was really hairy and the younger one wasn't. So he cooked a big goat soup, took it to his father, put a bit of goat skin on his arm. He said, "Is that really you?" Touched his arm and he took the blessing. But they are the two tribes. So the Amalekites are descendants of Esau. They are not happy that their blessing was taken. And they have held on to that grudge for 800 years. We still see this, don't we? We still see this all over the world. These divided societies who just don't let go of a kind of a community hatred. I'll tell a couple, by popular demand, I'll tell a couple of police stories. But I've policed in Northern Ireland in the riot season. And the level of hatred between two communities is unbelievable. But they don't really know what the hatred is about. It's just this hatred that's inbred. When you police a football match, you'll see the same between two risk group supporters. They just hate each other until they join together and then support England. And so, you know, this is really counter. And I want to look at how the counter currency applies here. So where did it take place for the geography students? Got a map. Everyone likes a map. Okay, with a big circle. It took place just there. This is modern day Israel. It took place in this place down in the south. And just to paint the story, David had gone 3 days north just to fight another battle. And while he was away, the Amalekites came in. So sometimes we read the Bible and we think, what's this got to do with me? It's a far off place in a far off time. You know, sort of thousands of years ago. What has it got to do with today? Well, actually, modern day Ziklag is this place called Kiryat Gat, which is in Israel. And I've made the circle land on the same spot. And this isn't at all to pass comment on the October the 7th attacks in Israel, but it's more just to show you how close they are. Here we've got a group of people invading another group of people and taking hostages. Repeating itself time and time again. So when you look at the Old Testament, if ever you feel it's in some far distant land at a distant time with distant tactics, actually it's happening now. So David is under complete pressure, isn't he? He's got back and he's feeling that pressure. They want to stone him. And we know stoning used to happen. You'd get buried in the ground up to your neck and then people would just stand around. You wouldn't be able to defend yourself and they would just hurl rocks at your head. He is a leader under pressure. And how would the world expect David to react? But the countercurrency, where does he look for strength? Where you look for strength, maybe where you place your value, where your currency is. Maybe you keep asking people for reassurance. Maybe they don't agree with you or give you the answer they want, so you keep seeking. Maybe that's where you get your strength from. Or maybe you're seeking some inner self-made strength. But David's demonstration is not like the world. He finds strength in the Lord. The account continues. Then he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring me the ephod." So Abiathar bought it. Then David asked the Lord, "Should I chase after this band of raiders? Will I catch them?" And the Lord told him, "Yes, go after them. You will surely recover everything that was taken from you." So David and his 600 men set out, and they came to the brook Besor. But 200 of the men were too exhausted to cross the brook, So David continued the pursuit with 400 men. So the ephod, in its simplest terms, this is an apron. And it's an apron worn to keep the white robes of the priest clean from the sacrifice. So in the Old Testament, different sacrifices would take place to try and kind of gain favor or have relationship with God. And they would all normally involve blood and gore. And the ephod was the apron that was used to stop the blood going on the white robes. Maybe sometimes we think we can make ourselves right with God. I had this grandmother who would give varying amounts of money to her local church, depending on how good her week had been. So if she'd had a good week, she'd give more money. And if she'd had a bad week, less money. Or maybe we put real value and we take a lot of currency in our church activities. Forgetting about Jesus, we just want to be seen to be doing stuff within church. But there's no need. And there's no need because of this new covenant, the cross. So unlike most other religions, Jesus has taken the action for us to be right with God. Holy and unholy can never meet. You know when you get two magnets and the two bits that don't stick together? You sort of push them. It doesn't matter what you do, they won't ever meet. Because holy and unholy can never meet. We are unholy. We know this because the world is out of kilter. We can put a man on the moon, but we can't get neighbors to get on. We just look, we see people seeking for things that just will never satisfy. But as we've just said, as we did communion, if we renounce the devil, seek forgiveness and turn to Christ, we seek forgiveness through Jesus, we are made holy in God's eyes. And we just sang, I stand faultless before the throne. So holy and unholy can't meet unless it's for the cross of Jesus. It's a new covenant. And there's nothing we can do for Jesus to love us more. And there's nothing we can do that will make him love us less. And this passage here just says, look, in the same way he took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is a new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. It's a new agreement between God and us. So David continues. Along the way, they found an Egyptian man in a field and brought him to David. They gave him some bread to eat and water to drink. They also gave him part of a fig cake and two clusters of raisins if he hadn't anything to drink for 3 days and nights. Before long, his strength returned. To whom do you belong and where do you come from? David asked him. I am an Egyptian, the slave of an Amalekite, he replied. My master abandoned me 3 days ago because I was sick. We were on our way back from raiding the Kerithites in the Negev, the territory of Judah, and the land of Caleb, and we had just burnt Ziklag. Will you lead me to this band of raiders? David asked. The young man replied, if you take an oath in God's name that you will not kill me or give me back to my master, then I will guide you to them. So we've discovered that the Amalekites had a bit of a reason and a grudge to hold for 800 years. But what about this slave? He's an Egyptian. We know that David's people had been held in slavery by the Egyptians just 300 years before. He had every reason to not like this slave. He's got that historical 300-year reason, but he's also got the three-day reason. 3 days ago, he burnt his village. But David's counter-currency is the opposite to the Amalekites. He seeks to bless this slave. He doesn't just give him bread and water, but he gives him raisin cake and figs. And it's too easy to ignore when we're on a mission. He could have just gone past looking, but he stopped to help this person, and that helping gave him a blessing. It's so easy to love like us, others like us, and it's so easy to seek shared belonging in hatred. I'm not sure about you, but you know, whether you're at school or uni or wherever you are, you get involved in these conversations where everyone's, this is my next visual aid, that's what I'm looking for. Everyone has a token, okay? So we've all got these tokens, haven't we? And we start talking and we're all talking about a particular person and someone tells you a story and you think, well, I've got a much worse story about this person because you never believe the time when they did whatever and you add your token into the conversation. And then someone else adds a token and you just keep this kind of, you're seeking kinship or belonging by having a worse thing to say about a person. David doesn't do that, and God's countercurrency isn't about that at all. It's about building people up and showing kindness. So the account continues. So he, the Egyptian, led David to them. They found the Amalekites spread out across a field, eating and drinking and dancing with joy because of the vast amounts of plunder they had taken from the Philistines and the land of Judah. David and his men rushed in among them and slaughtered them throughout the night and the entire next day until evening. None of the Amalekites escaped except 400 young men who fled on camels. David got everything the Amalekites had taken, and he rescued his two wives. Nothing was missing, great, small or great, son or daughter, or anything else that had been taken. David brought everything back. He also recovered the flocks and herds, and his men drove them ahead of them of the other livestock. This plunder belongs to David, they said. Ooh. And so here we are. A small comment on the violence of the Old Testament. So the first bit is we can see what a good tactician David is. If ever you do a raid, you want to do it when your enemy are least expecting it. Sometimes in the police, I did a great job where I used to just kick doors in and we'd arrest naughty people. And this guy was particularly naughty, and he used to drill people's kneecaps. He was an enforcer for a gang here in Devon. He's now in prison. You don't need to worry. So we choose a time, the time of our choosing, when he is most vulnerable. He had a particularly difficult door to open, so one of the guys looks like a delivery driver, so we always dress him up as a delivery driver with a whole range of outfits. Royal Mail, they don't like it anymore. Deliveroo, Amazon, we'll do everything. And then we knock on the door, sure enough, he opens it, we all run in our full riot gear and jump on top of him, and he was dressed only in his underpants. And as we led him away, his wife informed us, or his girlfriend informed us, he would have had us. I thought, yes, he probably would, had we not caught him early in the morning whilst he was still sleepy. And David employs exactly the same tactic. They're clearly drunk, they're partying. He's got them at the most vulnerable moment. But I think sometimes when we read the Old Testament, it's worth just commenting on the violence. And a lot of people are put off the Old Testament because it is so violent. But this is a Bible about a God of purity. God's uncompromising standard of purity and holiness. It's really easy, isn't it, in our culture to talk about Christmas. People are really happy that Jesus is a baby. People will put it on a card. They'll talk about it. Little baby Jesus. Okay, that's nice. And it kind of feels okay for us. But in a couple of weeks, when we get to Easter, Jesus, torn, tortured, and brutally crucified for us, is replaced with eggs and fluffy bunnies. Because it's too difficult for our culture to talk about. That consequence of being apart from God is frowned upon in today's society. It's watered down. It's made more palatable. It's a nice to have, not a matter of eternal life versus eternal death. But here we are. David goes in and everything's recovered in verse 18. That contrast between holiness and our unholiness. The violence and destruction versus the completeness of getting everything back. It's that countercultural thing. Isaac talked about it, where his friends responded to a nudge. No one normally does that in our normal culture, but they did. And then the next part says, then David returned to the brook Besor, and he met up with the 200 men who he had left behind because they were too exhausted to go with him. They went out to meet David and his men, and David greeted them joyfully. But some evil troublemakers among David's men said, they didn't go with us, so they can't have any of the plunder we recovered. Give them their wives and children, then tell them to be gone. But David said, no, my brothers, don't be selfish for what the Lord has given us. He has kept us safe and has helped us defeat this band of raiders that attacked us. Who will listen when you talk like this? We share and we share alike, those who go to battle and those who guard the equipment. From then on, David made this decree and a regulation for Israel that is still followed today. When he arrived at Ziklag, David sent out part of the plunder to the elders of Judah, who were his friends. "Here is a present for you, taken from the Lord's enemy," he said. The gifts were sent to the people of the following various towns, which you can read on the screen in front of me. So 200 men, they didn't go. They were exhausted. They waited by the river. David comes back. Bear in mind, he's marched south, got back. He's then had this moment where he's realized everyone's been taken hostage. He's then marched again. He's then done a long battle. He could have been exhausted. I'm sure he was. But he meets them with this God-given joy. And the 200 men, in Christ, we all work together. The church community is made up of many parts. It's described, isn't it, in the Bible, like a body with a head and an arms. And we can't all be each and every one of those, but we all need them. So this countercurrency, the upfront obvious jobs aren't the most important in Jesus' economy. Jesus was the ultimate servant king, recognizing strengths when people were tired, hurting, and broken. But Jesus' countercurrency will overflow with blessing for those around us. And this multiple blessings and attributes it to God. So he gives off all these gifts and he attributes it to God. The world will tell us, why do we share? What's the point in sharing? It's all about us. Keep things close. You know, that fear to hold it close to us. But we share, like David did, with an open hand. We expect nothing in return. We lent our house last summer to some people, and everyone at work couldn't understand why we would do that. Is it to make money? Is it to look after the dog? For what reason are you doing it? We do it for no reason, because we want to live out a life like Jesus. We do it for nothing in return. We do it because it's what God has done for us. So I'd like to finish with five key takeaways. So if you've not been listening, this is your slide, okay? And I've even done the most important point is in red. Okay, so here we go. So the countercurrency of Christ, and this is what I've picked out on each of the points. In that time of crisis, do you look to God? If you don't, the thing you're looking to is probably where you put your currency. And then do you feel freedom in the new covenant? The concept that nothing you do makes God love you more and nothing you do makes him love you less. That agreement between you and God that you can stand before the throne because of what Jesus has done. Do you seek belonging by hating other groups? That idea of the tokens, that you're trying to be part of something by adding in a token about someone else. Is your faith watered down by society? Do you grasp the contrast of God's holiness and our unholiness? Or has it been watered down into something far more palatable? And then how do you live in Jesus' economy? His economy is the opposite to the Insta world, the dog-eat-dog society. It's about loving enemies, living in community, believing God works through people who've messed up, rewards those who are faithful. So what is my currency? What is my value? It's an uncompromising commitment to God. And I'll just finish with this story, which actually I found far more emotional in the first round. So we had a discussion at our house about when we last cried, and I couldn't remember. So this is quite an emotional story. So on the way back from ENC side, my parents had come down to watch Rosie get baptized. And they were traveling back. And anyone who travels from Cornwall to the Cotswolds must stop at M&S in Cribbs Causeway because it's the rule if you're over 70. So they went in for their monthly visit to M&S. And when they were in there, they're just overflowing with joy about what had happened. And so they speak to the girl behind the counter, and she was explaining that she kind of thought about getting baptized once, but couldn't really find a church. So in that moment, they pray with her. They email Woodlands Church in Bristol, connect her into a church, email the vicar, keep in contact, job done. You know, that uncompromising commitment to God. I could not care less what car my dad drives. I couldn't care less what job he's had. I couldn't care less if, you know, anything else that the world and the status would give them. That uncompromising commitment to God in an M&S just to try and kind of always put God first. That, to me, is where our counter currency should be. And that's what we should be doing through Jesus. So let me just pray, and then I'll hand over to Tabby. I'll give you more of a warning. Heavenly Father, I just thank you that you teach us a way to live differently. You teach us a way to live differently because of what you've done for us. That very crux of Christianity, that you lived and you died on a cross and you rose again. And you did that so that we could stand before your throne, blameless, where unholiness and holy can meet. You bridge that gap. And I just pray that you will speak to us and you'll highlight areas of our lives that we want to live differently. Amen.